the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart. Now, just before we get started today, just a warning, there are some themes and some language in today's program that may not be suitable for young kids. If you have children around, you might want to put on some headphones or catch up on the podcast later.
When I first heard a little bit about our guest's story, it sounded like the plot of a blockbuster movie. There's diamond smuggling and conflict and romance and, of course, major plot twists. But if so, that film would be based on a true story, as they say.
Yeah. Yes, Mark Leach was born in a village in Zambia. He trained as a doctor in South Africa and now finds himself in Sydney as an Anglican minister, among other roles, including business consulting and work with International Justice Mission. Mark is in the studio to help us fill in the blanks. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, your story starts in Zambia. Can you tell us a little bit about life there and growing up there?
Well, no, not really, because I can't remember much. We left when I was fairly young, but I was born in this little village called Choma. My father was at the time, was a bank manager, a white South African Afrikaans background, and my mum was a German Jew who had been a refugee from the Holocaust and moved to Swaziland with her parents in 1938, been smuggled out through Holland and landed from going from the heart of Frankfurt in Germany. My grandfather's a very successful doctor in practice with a Gentile, and then they landed in a tiny village in Swaziland. And mum grew up, became a doctor, met my dad. He was a very charming, intelligent person who, as it turned out, was capable of many interesting things.
Yes, so I think your parents split up later, right?
Yes.
And you moved to Zimbabwe with your mother,
yep. But
you spent your summers in South Africa with your dad.
That's right.
Who was a diamond smuggler. Is this right?
Well, yes. The reason we left Zambia was because he started off as a mercenary. His initial vocation, he grew up very poor in the Depression in Johannesburg in South Africa, and left home at 14 and went to make his way in the wide world and ended up fighting in the Congo in the 60s in the Katanga Rebellion. And then worked his way down through Africa. So I grew up actually hearing, one of my earliest memories of my dad is him telling stories of fighting as a mercenary in Congo. And
tell us a little bit about that then. That must have been some colourful stories in your childhood hearing that. And did that sound just like that was all you knew, so that you thought that's what people do? Or what was that like?
Well, I was very familiar with war because after Zambia, we had to leave Zambia because the police were after him. He was in the bank. He was doing a bunch of foreign currency smuggling for a bunch of other businesses. So we got on a plane to Switzerland on the Friday, and an internal investigations unit from Barclays head office landed in Lusaka on the Saturday morning. And we went off to stay with my grandparents for 6 months in Switzerland while the dust settled. And then we relocated to Zimbabwe. It was Rhodesia at the time, in the middle of a civil war. And then my dad got into smuggling emeralds initially, and then he left, moved down to South Africa, kept up the emerald business, and then segued later in life into diamonds. So I grew up in a context where there was lots of war, lots of violence. To be honest, the stories were completely inappropriate for any sane adult to tell their child.
For example?
A group of rebels captured some of their team, and they tracked them down overnight, and they were about an hour behind the group who left the camp. And when they came into the camp, my dad saw his best friend strung up by the hands from a tree with his eyes gouged out, his tongue cut out, his penis cut off and shoved in his mouth, and tortured to death. And I was eight when I first heard that story.
Yeah, that's not normal bedtime stories,
no.
So fair, is it?
No, Dad was quite spectacularly poorly equipped to be a parent.
Give us a sense of some of the sorts of things you used to do with your dad.
Well, one of the most vivid memories I have, I probably would have been about 10 years old, and at this stage I was on holidays with my father. He had a quarry up in the bush in northeastern South Africa, which was a front for the guys bringing emeralds in across from Rhodesia and Zambia. And one Friday afternoon, it was payday. He was paying the workers who worked in the quarry, and they were all lined up, and it was hot, and it was just my dad and me. I was standing next to him, and I was kind of proud, you know, little boy, and the dad's the big boss, and all these guys coming up to get money, and he's paying them in cash. And then from out of the blue, a guy runs at him with a great big knife, what's called a panga. And the guy's running, so my dad just reached down, pulled out the gun that he always carried, and I remember standing there frozen and thinking, he's going to kill him. My dad's going to shoot this guy, and being just terrified. So I moved to the side. The guy came rushing at Dad with the panga up, and my dad, instead of shooting him, which I'm so glad he didn't, he stepped, because the guy was pretty drunk. So as the guy came by, my dad just sidestepped him and took the pistol and smashed him on the side of the head and knocked him unconscious, and then they dragged him off. That was fairly traumatic. Another time Dad came to visit, he hadn't been so lucky. He came to pick us up, and I went to give him a hug, and he winced, and he'd been stabbed in the back and in the lung, and took my hand away, and he was bleeding through the dressing.
So your father started taking you along on some of his activities later. Was there a sense in which, you know, you were ever going to be going down this line? Did he expect that?
Oh, gosh, no. My father couldn't think that far ahead, really. He was very much just, here's the next deal, here's the next thing he was working on. No, I was quite different to my dad, but and I had different models. So my mum was a doctor, so she was a GP, and her Jewish family in South Africa ran one of the largest family-owned businesses in the country at the time. So I had this, and my grandparents had retired. My grandfather ended up as a very senior doctor with the World Health Organization. So I had this really bizarre life where I'd go to school during the term in Rhodesia in the middle of the war, and I had friends' dads going into the bush and people being killed. And then I'd go and spend two out of the three holidays, because it was a three-year term, with my dad in South Africa. And those were really awful, genuinely unpleasant times a lot of the time. You know, I have memories of, you know, bouncing around in the back of a ute in the middle of the bush in the middle of the night while Dad was doing deals and trades, and there were guns and knives and spectacularly inappropriate context for a 10-year-old little white kid. And then I'd go and stay with my Jewish family in Johannesburg, and it was polo ponies and private jets and friends with the Mandela family. And then I'd go to Switzerland over the Christmas, and we'd, you know, leave. We'd take off from Harare Airport, or Salisbury Airport as it was then, and the plane would just go. All the pilots for Air Rhodesia were Air Force pilots, and you'd take off almost vertically because they were afraid of surface-to-air missiles taking you out, and then you'd fly in darkness, and then you'd land in Zurich, and it would be peaceful and rich and safe, and it just kind of was quite weird, but it was normal. You know, when you grow up as a kid, it's all normal, right?
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. So at the time, were you conscious of this being a sort of strange existence, or was this just what you were got accustomed to?
It's just normal, and I still find it, it's just my story, right? So I still have to remind myself occasionally that other people, it sounds weird, other people haven't had upbringings like that. And it sort of, and it shapes you, and it gives you a certain spin on the world. And
yeah, let's think about that for a moment. How has some of that shaped who you are now?
It's shaped me intellectually in the most, I guess this is the best way to describe it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that the line between good and, he was writing in a Russian gulag, and he said, the line between good and evil doesn't lie between nation states or cultures. It goes right through the heart of every human being. And so I've seen that. You know, I've seen even my dad, who in many ways was not a very pleasant man and capable of extraordinary thoughtlessness and evil, but was also could be a very loving and generous father. I saw just immense cruelty from the same people who could be incredibly loving. Later in my life, my peers, including my brother in South Africa, by the time we'd moved to Cape Town in the mid-80s, the heart of the anti-apartheid struggle, and South Africa was fighting a war in Angola, and my brother and all my friends were conscripted and fought in that. And these lovely white boys from a lovely elite boys' school went into the army as 18-year-olds and committed war crimes. And so but they were the same guys that come back and go to church with me. So I think the effect, I think war is evil. It's just evil. You can't participate in war without participating in evil. For me, a big driver in my life was to change the script and change the multi-generational story of brokenness and evil and dysfunction. And the only reason I haven't committed the evil that I'm capable of is I haven't had the time and the opportunity. Now I pray to God that in that situation I would be different, but I'm not that optimistic. And the other thing I'd say out of my Jewish background, you know, I grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust. Many of my family died in Germany. But, you know, every concentration camp guard went home and made love to his wife and cuddled his kids, you know, shoveled bodies in an oven during the day and tucked his kids in at night. And, you know, that framework has had a huge impact on me.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Mark Leach about his rather fascinating life story.
Somewhere in the midst of this quite unusual mix of your childhood and youth, you became a Christian. How did that come about?
Well, we moved to Cape Town, and my mum had been a secular Jew, so like many German Jews, very secular. And so she'd converted to Roman Catholicism to marry my father. And I think their wedding was the last time my dad went to church. But mum was pretty faithful. So she'd take us along to the Catholic Church because she'd promised the priest when they got married that she'd do that. So I'd go along to the Catholic Church. But then we'd do Jewish holidays and Shabbat with my cousins in Joburg. And so, you know, I had Catholic guilt and Jewish guilt. It was a wonderful combination.
You're just racked with guilt.
Yeah, just guilt, man. You know, that's right. I was actually in a conversation the other day and I said, you know, my ideal therapist would be a strictly Freudian woman. I think this is just, I'd love to just, you know, sit there and maybe if she was a Catholic as well, it'd be just perfect. So as a 15-year-old boy, I'd never been to a Protestant church. I'd stopped going to the Catholic church and I was at this big boys' school. And some friends of my brother's invited us to go to this youth group. And I went along for a very simple reason. The youth group had what my school didn't have, girls. So I went for the girls. I think, you know, the key to any successful youth ministry really is unresolved sexual tension, much like any soap opera or sitcom. And the problem, of course, is when you resolve it, all the drama disappears. Yeah. So I went along for the girls. And there I heard people talk about God in a way I'd never heard before. They said I could have a personal relationship with God through Jesus. And I thought, well, that's weird. And then they said, I needed to have Jesus in my heart. And I thought, that's even stranger. And then they used this phrase that I'd never heard before. They said, you need to be born again. And I thought, what the heck is that? So I spent about a year thinking and arguing about that. And deeply afraid of God, actually, and afraid that God would abandon me like my father had and that he would be as unreliable as my earthly father. So I was really scared. I kind of thought, it sounds good news. Like, it sounds amazing if it's true. Like, wow, why wouldn't anyone want a personal relationship with God? But I thought, what if I ask God into my life and then nothing happens and he doesn't love me and nothing changes?
Or he turns out to be a father like you were experiencing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's unreliable and mean and capricious. And, yep.
Yeah. So you eventually came to accept this. In what way did your life change because of that?
Well, that was in 1985. So 31 years later, my life's still changing. It's one of those things. For me, it was this extraordinarily powerful encounter with God. I studied medicine. I'm a bit of a rationalist thinker. Apparently, some people tell me, I'm not a super touchy-feely kind of guy. And I think that's part of the product of my upbringing. You know, like I had to be very resilient and self-reliant. Really, you realize very soon in the life I grew up in, you've got to make life work by yourself because everyone else is going to let you down, screw you over, take advantage of you. But what God did on that night in May 1985 was just, it's beyond words almost, this experience of extraordinary love and forgiveness and hope. And it's like everything that was broken and evil and distorted and shame-filled was just resolved in this experience of love from God. Mm-hmm. And it transformed my life. It changed all sorts of things.
How did your family respond to that decision?
Yes. How do you think they might have responded? Not so well. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, I'm not sure I can use this word on air, but, you know, my dad used to then call me. He was in prison at the time by then, and he used to call me, oh, my born-again Christian motherfucker, you know. And I said, Dad, that's not that helpful, you know. but at least I knew where he stood. Mum, you know, had this massive confluence of Jewish and Catholic guilt. It's like, I failed as a Jew. I failed as a Catholic. He's become this crazy Protestant nut. So it took a little while for Mum and Dad. And in the end, you know, my dad, he died of cancer in 1999. And my brother, with whom I don't have a great relationship, he did one beautiful thing for me. He went to my dad when he was dying in Cape Town, and he said to my dad, and I'll turn the language down. He said, you know, Dad, you've effed up your life. You've effed up my life. You've effed up Mark's life. The least you can do is say sorry to him before you die. And I walked into my dad's room, and he was at home and, you know, self-medicating as African-style palliative care. And Dad had he's dying of lung cancer and liver cancer, riddled with cancer. And he's got a cigarette in one hand. He's got a bottle of morphine in the other hand and a bottle of whiskey next to that. And he was just smoke, morphine, whiskey. And he looked up from the table and he said, you know, he said, Mark, I'm sorry. Can you forgive me? I just said, you know, Dad, every time I walk into this room, I'm forgiving you. It's okay.
So what was your experience of your church like then?
Wow. Well, here's the thing. In this little youth group that I'd been attending, there'd been an older man who'd been very influential in my journey and had got alongside of me, helped me in the youth group, helped explain this whole Christian thing to me, told me I needed God in my life, told me I needed to be born again. And in fact, he was the guy who took me. There was this big event that I went to in 1985 where I had this encounter with God. And he was there at that, and he drove me home after that. He also sexually abused me. And for 20 years, he'd been grooming young boys like me in the youth group and a whole bunch of my friends. And the church elders knew about it and covered it up and pretended it wasn't that bad. And so for me, that was the worst of Christianity. And I still go, how can someone who claims to be a Christian behave like that? And yet, because of my upbringing, I just knew human beings were capable of extraordinary evil and great good. So for me, I mean, I was angry, I was hurt. I went back when I was 22. I was in Australia then. I went back and spent 6 weeks confronting this guy and talking to other victims and isolating him and trying to, you know, talking to the police and spray painting his wall. You know, Jim abuses kids all across his big front wall, because I was a little angry. But I always knew that it wasn't about people. The God wasn't like that. It was crystal clear. All that suffering and the evil that I experienced then at the hands of Christians and the profound failure of church leaders to protect a young boy and other young boys like me never caused me to doubt God.
That's amazing, Mark, because I think it'd be amazing for anyone to have had that experience and come to that conclusion. Mm. But especially given your background, and then you've been introduced to what you say was sort of this life-changing, yep, life-affirming thing, mm, and yet it came with this awful darkness, mm, attached to it. It's amazing that you would were you able then to kind of distinguish between that kind of evil and the goodness of God that you are now relating to?
Do you know, at the time, No, because I didn't realize it was abuse. It's one of the most insidious and evil things that the pedophiles do is they get inside your head. It's almost worse than what they do to your body is how they distort how you see them and how you see the world. So at the time, I outgrew this guy and distanced myself fairly quickly from him, but I didn't realize quite how evil he was until probably 4 or 5 years later. I wish I could tell you there was, here's three easy steps. So if you're struggling with this, these are the three things you've got to do, and you too could come to that. I just think it's, for me, I just think it happens to be true. You know what, actually, even more than that, for me, the reality of suffering is the greatest reason I actually think Christianity is true. I actually think lots of people go, oh, suffering is this massive insurmountable problem to ethical monotheism. Can there be a good God who's also powerful? I think it's one of the reasons I'm still a Christian, because I think, heck, in Christianity, there are questions around suffering for sure. Like, I often think, you know, God, couldn't you have organized the first 20 of my years of my life a little differently? I would have loved to have just, you know, not had some of the stuff happen to me that happened to me. But if there is no God, or if there's a God who doesn't love us enough to die for us and come to heal us and experience the full force of evil and human wickedness on himself, if none of that's true, I'd still have had the evil. The evil doesn't go away just because I stop believing in God. So if I believe in God, and if Christianity is true, and look, it might not be, but if it's true, then at least there's hope. I know there's going to be a time when God's going to wipe away my tears, and he's going to bind up the brokenhearted and make everything that's crooked and broken and bent out of shape straight, and he's going to make everything that's been battered and made ugly by the world beautiful, and he's going to make everything that's dead alive. So that's the hope. And for whatever reason, I've never found it hard to believe in that hope.
You mentioned that you wanted to rewrite the script from your upbringing. Mm. How are you going with that? I mean, you've got your own family. Is it a new script?
You'd have to ask my wife. But I'm not in jail. I'm not an alcoholic. I've been faithful to my wife. I love my kids. I don't expose them to awful things. So I think so. And I think that's, you know, combination of my own, the choices I've made for sure, the capacity I had. I had this discussion the other day with someone, and I said, the problem with learning from me is I think I'm off the scale in terms of resilience. I just find it, and lots of other people aren't. So, but in the midst of changing that script, the experience of God loving me and his grace and just mercy in my life has changed that, changed me deeply. That's it. I'm still a work in progress, you know. I discover new levels of brokenness and new ways in which my past comes back to bite me in the bum. And that means sometimes I hurt people and I don't care for them and love them the way I want to. But I'm being renewed. It's an amazing thing. Could never have, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, Mark, could your life have ended up like this? I would have gone, I can only hope.
Mark, you talk about this line between good and evil and your life, you've experienced, you're more familiar with that, I think. Mm. You've seen that up close more than most people. And you've chosen along the way in lots of ways to be someone who helps other people. Mm. At one point you started studying to be a doctor while you were still in South Africa. You're not a doctor now.
No.
What happened there?
I went into medicine because it's what every good Jewish boy does if they can get the marks. At the end of my first year in medical school, I went and spent a month working in a refugee camp on the border of South Africa and Mozambique. There was a war going on in Mozambique and lots of refugees coming across the border, walking across the Kruger National Park and living in terrible conditions. So a group of students, we went up there and I spent a month living in this camp. And I was a first-year medical student and my mum was a doctor and I was one of the best-equipped medicos in this particular refugee camp. They were so poor and so short of resources. And I had this experience where we went into the camp and there was a little girl who'd pulled a pot of boiling water off the campfire over her and she was dying. and, you know, holding a little dying refugee in my arms made me aware that my life couldn't be about my own status and security. These are the things that drove my family, you know, when you... You know, you go into medicine because it's secure. You know, my family had survived the Holocaust and made a life for themselves because they had a profession, and you could always survive if you're a doctor. And, you know, and I was really driven by that. And looking at that child, I just realized my life couldn't be about that. So that started me on a journey of thinking, well, if it's not about status and security, what is it about? And so that led me. That led me out of medicine because I, out of my Christian faith, I'd come to the view that Jesus was the physician of our souls, that in Jesus lay a divine healing that went deeper than anything medicine could offer. One of the things my lecturers at medical school never told me was that all my patients would die one day. And which is quite funny because actually at the University of Cape Town, the medical school and the teaching hospital is built right next to a cemetery. So, you know, it's kind of, that's where your failures go, people.
Ominous, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's true, right? So for me, death was always there. And I thought, if death is the end of life, there is no hope. But if Jesus has brought an answer to death, that great enemy, I just increasingly felt I wanted to help people come to that same experience of love and grace and hope that I had. So that took me out of medicine and to study theology and, yeah.
I want to ask you about International Justice Mission.
Yeah.
Tell us what they do and why do you get involved?
You know, there's 35 to 40 million people in the world who live in slavery. That's like substantially more than the entire population of Australia. And as part of slavery, they suffer just great violence. And IJM's mission was to eradicate violence against the poor. And the particular sort of violence that they're working against is the violence of slavery and injustice. And they wanted to prove that justice for the poor is possible, that if the God of the Bible is true, then... He's about bringing about justice in the world. So how could they do that? So what they set up is a model of work where they rescue people from slavery and oppression and injustice. They rehabilitate people. But then, and this is the bit I really love because there's lots of NGOs doing those first two bits. Then what IJM do is they work to reform the justice systems in the developing world, in countries where the poor are oppressed. And they have a very clever and very effective theory of change that they are now proving over 20 years actually works. So in the Philippines, where we work, there's been a six-fold reduction of young girls trafficked in the sex trade in a number of cities in the Philippines where IJM works, because what they do is work with the local authorities to get the local institutions working so that perpetrators of sexual violence and human trafficking can't make a profit out of it. They use market forces to disrupt the economy of slavery. So suddenly it gets much too costly. And they just go, look, if I'm using an underage girl in my brothel, I'm likely to be caught and prosecuted. So they take away the impunity with which evil is practiced in these places, which disrupts the market. And, you know, because most trafficking and most of the porn industry, most of the sex industry, it's not about sex or porn, it's just about money. And so once you make it too costly for people to make money out of slavery, they do something else. So it's an incredibly hopeful, wonderful organization. I love being involved. I just feel so privileged because I found a way I can make a little bit of a difference to those people living in the kind of violence that I grew up in.
A lot of these experiences that you've had or that you're now involved with your upbringing and in South Africa and then with IJM, a lot of these more extreme experiences we tend to think of as kind of more gritty, real life. But you've also lived in Toronto and here in Sydney, these nice suburban lives. And we tend to think of that, you know, those more cushy existences as not really real life. What do you think about that, having kind of lived both sides of that coin?
Look, at one level, boring is good. There is no glamour in poverty. There is no glamour in violence at all. But I actually see a lot of really miserable people in Sydney. I see a city or people where we are so rich, we have so much. And yet we're actually so miserable. It's like all the things that we have that we shove into our souls to try and ease that ache just don't work. So, you know, I have an epidemic of you know, mental health and dis-ease in our culture. And I wonder where that comes from. And I think it's great. I love Sydney. I mean, and there's no glamour in poverty, but I think what I encounter in Sydney actually is a lot of people for whom they just don't have a transcendent purpose in their lives. Like, why are they here? And then you can make sense of it and find meaning in it no matter where you live. You know, you can be in a harbourside mansion in Mossman, or you can be in a refugee camp in the eastern part of the DRC where we were 2 years ago. And, you know, if you found a transcendent purpose in your life, that gives and brings meaning no matter what the context is in which you live.
Do you have a strong sense of what you're here for? And what's your purpose in life?
My purpose at this season of my life and where I'm at, and the thread that unites what I do in the corporate world and in the church world and with IJM is, in this season of life, my goal is to grow fruit on other people's trees. I just want to help other people flourish, you know. I think God has been so good to me, and whatever good things I've got, whatever, and you know, that's why I'm sharing my story. You probably can't tell this by listening, but it's really painful for me, actually. I've been in tears as I've been talking, and I do it because whatever has happened to me, I want it to be of use to others, and I want to grow fruit on other people's trees.
Well, Mark, it's a fascinating story, very engaging. You have a great way of telling it, and we appreciate your honesty and the authenticity in the way you've come in and told it. So thank you so much for coming.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. If you enjoyed this interview with Mark Leach, you can discover more conversations like this on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on iTunes. Just type CPX in the search box to find us. While you're there, feel free to subscribe to Life and Faith and tell us what you think of the program by leaving us a rating or review.